Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and thanks for downloading our podcast this week. I'm John Montgomery. Our subject is going to be pre-visualization. It's a subject I really find quite interesting. I was fortunate enough last year to head out to LA to check out the VES Festival of Effects. And there was a panel discussion out there with members from leading previs companies, including Chris Edwards, who's our guest this week on the FX podcast. And it was a really fascinating discussion. Now, previs has obviously been around for a while. You consider even storyboards a form of previs. But as technology has advanced, they've become much more intricate. Take, for example, say George Lucas on the first Star Wars. He would actually edit together, it's called actually Steel-O-Matics or Rip-O-Matics, real footage of fighter pilot footage during air-to-air battles. And it's amazing how closely that documentary or reality footage actually ends up paralleling what you see in the final output of Star Wars. It's really quite convincing. And without that motion, I don't think you would have conveyed that same sense of reality that you did from those films. Another example, and a fun one actually, is in Return of the Jedi. Actually, Dennis Muren used Star Wars figurines and a lipstick camera and kind of a jungle diorama on a table to convey the battle sequence for the Jedi chase the jungle. Really fascinating. While kind of comical on one level watching the footage, these little figurines, it really does accurately, again, convey the final product. And actually, I think it's on Attack of the Clones. There are special add-on packages on the DVD. Actually have a little segment called State of the Art, the previs of episode 2, which is really interesting. Actually, our guest on the FX podcast a couple weeks ago, Ben Snow, I actually think has a cameo in that as well. I'm kind of speaking about Star Wars in part because our guest this week, Chris Edwards, actually got him start on Skywalker Ranch. He did a lot of previs for George Lucas, including working very closely with him on episode 3, actually on the third floor, and that's where his company, an offshoot of that, no longer associated with that, the third floor came into being. The company is located in LA and now does pre-viz work for feature films, gaming, TV commercials, and more. It's really fascinating. I wouldn't say there's a film that's done nowadays without pre-viz. It's really become a huge market and a really fascinating subject. So without further rambling on my part, let's go ahead and join the conversation. Mike Seymour speaking with Chris Edwards of the third floor.
Thanks for that. And thank you, Chris, for joining us. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's great to be here.
So I guess before we get started in discussing any specific projects, I'd love to get a quick plotted history of Third Floor, because I must admit, while John, my business partner, knew everything about you, it seemed, I was much more in the dark as to the history of where you'd come from.
And
it's a fascinating story.
Well, I'm always surprised when people know about us, because, I mean, we're just a band of brothers from Skywalker Ranch that met up there during THX 1138 remake for direct-to-DVD and for Star Wars Episode III pre-production. And so we just stick together and are continuing to do that kind of work and don't really advertise that much. We're just working one filmmaker at a time, trying to make the best previs that we can muster. And but that experience was pretty crazy. It's not a job that you really get to read about in the paper or online. It's through friends of friends, or you're identified by Lucasfilm to come up there and interview and possibly be a part of this team to help make history with George.
And I think you joked once that it was a bit like being selected by the Matrix, that they sort of found you out.
Oh, it is. It's very bizarre. Fortunately, I got a chance to run into a guy named David DeZoritz, who was one of the original previous supervisors up there. Every time George makes a movie, he goes in and creates a new team of guys, because there's usually a lag of a number of years of shooting and post-production that happened in between the projects. So luckily for me, they had this opportunity to create a whole new team, and so I was just one of those guys. And we all came together as part of this 3D component of the Lucasfilm art department. So on one side, we had this group of guys like Ryan Church and Ian McKeag and Fang Zhu, and these great, amazing concept artists, sculptors, creature designers. And they would inspire us on the 3D side to make all of those pieces, parts, environments, characters, creatures. And we would use those toys to create scenes for George. And this was all done without the use of any storyboards or any real script, for that matter, actually. It was all through direct interaction with the director and being very inspired by this concept artwork and a lot of input from the editorial team, since they cut together found footage from old movies like they used to do on the original Star Wars. And that became those sequences, for some of the action sequences, became the rough blueprint for the kinds of dynamic action that they wanted us to produce for the film. So what we ended up doing together, this team of 10 guys, is basically produce previs for the movie three times over. Like 7,000 shots is what we roughly calculated by the end of it all. And
it wasn't just George Lucas either, because you were saying that Steven Spielberg actually did some directing on that film.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know that. It's very very funny that that never came out, or that they didn't want to publicize that. I guess they figured it'd be popular enough without really using the Steven Spielberg card. But really, it just came out of the fact that I heard that Steven really wanted to work on a Star Wars movie, and he always missed his opportunity since he was always so busy with his own projects. And this was his last opportunity, just like it was our last opportunity. So he carved out a little bit of time in his schedule and came to visit us once or twice, but for the most part, he directed via fax machine, where he would take the little Steven Spielberg doodles that he would make, which were very rough little conceptual drawings of, without even any framing or anything, just it's probably like the fifth grade level, but the ideas behind the artwork, behind the drawings there were great. And we would receive them on the fax machine and sort of have to come to terms with what our daily workload was going to be. We're like, what is this? And we would at first oftentimes think it was a little bit too over the top or too crazy, but I think Steven is one of these guys that knows that the director has to be really potent at the top of the chain here, so that by the time it gets interpreted and watered down to some extent by all of the individual artists working on the vision, that it still retains some potency. And so that's what he did, is he made some really ambitious sequences that were, namely the ones where Emperor Palpatine was fighting Yoda. That whole sequence was mostly his ideas, as well as a lot of the stuff that happened around the Wookiee planet, Kashyyyk, and a lot of other action that happened on the Grievous side over there when he was on the that big sinkhole planet with the lizard and Obi-Wan. So some of the more dynamic scenes there, other than the space battles, were directed by Steven.
Hmm. Now, you're sort of moving the clock forward, splitting now from being literally on the third floor at Skywalker Ranch and setting up the company. And it's pretty much the majority of the team from that experience went into the new company, didn't they?
That's right, yeah. I mean, I somehow managed to gain the support of seven of the original 10 guys, and they all came down and joined forces. At first, it was a little precarious since we didn't have any investors or anything. We were just all putting our own life savings into it so that we could survive for a bit while we got an office and basically wanted to start offering the same kind of really high-quality previs that we were doing for George and Steven, but to the rest of the world, and to open everyone's eyes to the potential of adding more detail into previs. I think previous to in the past, previs came out of a need to do very complicated visual effect shots, and so it became more of a technical exercise. And these days, I think previs can be used for a lot more conceptual reasons, still have a solid grounding in visual effects reality so that real information can be garnered from it. But that the most important thing is to please the director and all of his artistic collaborators by putting together a vision of the movie. And that vision has to be detailed enough to really be able to critique it. And so that's what we attempted to do at the ranch and what we're continuing to try to refine here at the new third floor.
Now, we're going to discuss in a second an example of a couple of ways that previous work with other material from one of your feature films and also actually a specific shot. But before we do that, I just want to take a side tangent and mention that you do work other than just feature films.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, we realized perhaps out of necessity just to stay alive when we have limited contacts to do commercials and feature films and also video game cinematics. And at first I was thinking, oh, you know, well, we'll just slum it in video games and commercials for a while and then someday work our way back to features when we've earned it. And but to be honest, we enjoy all three disciplines. And in fact, you know, sometimes the video game universe is even more exciting because a lot of times the guys that are developing the games are very focused on making great gameplay and play mechanics and are so busy doing that towards the end of production that they are completely overwhelmed and can't even think about how the story is going to play out or how the marketing materials are going to work with the cinematics that need to frame the gamer's experience. And so some of our very first clients, actually from Japanese companies that have trusted us to design their cinematics, and I knew that if we could make that work overseas with different languages involved and a lot of video conferencing, and it still turned out to be a really pleasing, mutually beneficial experience, that we could work with just about anybody.
Some of those titles include what? Lost Odyssey, Lair, and Command
and
Conquer.
Yeah, well, Lost Odyssey, the director and creator of Final Fantasy, that was our first project in our studio space. And Lair, Big Dragon Cinematic for PlayStation 3. Also, we've been working for EA and doing Command & Conquer, a couple games of Command & Conquer, Need for Speed, Pro Street, and Beyond. And also Resident Evil 5 was one of our biggest projects. And then I guess last but not least, we had the great pleasure of working with the guys over at Blizzard Entertainment on the next StarCraft game.
And these are like Rolls-Royce properties. These really are the tent poles of some of these bigger companies. So, I mean, there's very much pressure on these as there are on major feature films.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're just as flattered to receive the job to go in and be these consultants or to work with them to enhance their stories through the cinematics. I think it's been an amazing experience. We've also worked on some pretty exciting commercials that are some of our more intense experiences. It's like a feature film but compressed down into 2 to 4 weeks, and you've got to really know your chops then because you've got to be able to please 4 to 5 different agencies or entities that are involved in critiquing this, yet it still has to get done in that short period of time.
Yeah, I loved your Pepsi pinball method job.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's one of the most complicated ones we've ever done is I don't know if everyone remembers it, but we did a commercial that has to do with turning San Francisco into a gigantic life-size pinball machine. So a guy is tortured on a ball by bouncing around the city, and we were responsible for that torture. I'm very proud of that because we had to go out to San Francisco and basically just make virtual versions through surveying of all of the locations, quick previs, and then all kinds of support on set and feeding motion control data back to the guys that needed to reproduce these moves several times. And so, yeah, in some projects we're very conceptually oriented, and in other projects we get involved in the technical support. And it depends on who the clients are and which type of project we're endeavoring to do. So one of the first things I ask is, you know, what do you want to get out of this project? And what scares you the most, filmmaker? And so usually they say, well, this opening sequence I'm really excited to get into, and that ending, ooh, that's going to be really complicated. I don't know how that's going to exactly play out. So I say, all right, let's do those first, and then time permitting, we can get into some of these other scenes. But, you know, a lot of people just say that previs is useful only for when you need to explode a dinosaur or do something really technically complicated, which involves a lot of visual effects. But the kinds of previews we've been doing these days is more about, I mean, it also includes a lot of big visual effects, but it's more about having the director and his collaborators, the art director, the cinematographer, the editor, all working together to make sure that they test out exactly what they want to do, to hone in on the best quality sequence. And sometimes what we're doing is we're staging dramatic sequences. Doesn't have anything to do with technical implementation, really.
I guess. A lot of us are sort of used to
the director's undo button.
Exactly. A lot of us sort of would think of previs as, I need to solve this structurally in terms of working out where cameras can be to get the coverage on a particular action sequence. But let's discuss that role in terms of storytelling by, if we can. I know you've done a bunch of stuff with Cloverfield and Narnia and stuff. And there are two stories from Narnia, or rather two scenes from Narnia, that I think really are interesting to if we could talk about,
sure.
And they are the battle where the battle field collapses, and then later where the river god appears. And so various members of your team worked on Narnia. So maybe we could just discuss those by way of comparison, because there are two interesting ways of working that aren't just, well, here is the exactly what's going to happen, and you just work out what size lens to use. And let's start with the battlefield, because I went back and looked at the original text after I'd seen the film, and that doesn't play as a big part of a book chapter. It's about two paragraphs.
Yeah, it's a pretty short novel. I think it's just about 100 pages or something. So, first I wanted just to say that this is one of the best experiences we've ever had in terms of the trust level of the director of the professional previous team. And whenever you have a situation like that where the director really has a lot of faith in the people that he's collaborating with, that's when I think some of the best work can happen. And when the production believes in the director so much that they sort of leave him or her alone for that golden period of time before the rolling Indiana Jones ball of production comes rolling down to crush them, that's when you need to really carpe diem and get those sequences ironed out. But in the case of the two points you were talking about, we had two very different approaches. One was the big battle sequence that you mentioned. And that one was more of an iterative process, where we started with one preconception about how the battle would play out, and it was done in previs to the T. And we all sat back and watched it. And the director critiqued it and was like, oh, well, this is what we've been working on, and I like it. I think it's a strong sequence, but it reminds me of the one of the big battle sequence in the previous Narnia, and I want to avoid that. And also, hey, we have some extra time here. I really want to make this the best sequence that we can make. And so anybody have any ideas? And this is a small meeting with the previs guys and the editor and the DP and everyone involved, and out of that discussion came a whole bunch of really cool shot ideas. Some one-off shots, others are whole concepts for how to change the battle. And one of those concepts was that maybe the battlefield has caves that run out from where they're holed up there in their base, the Aslan's Howl, I think they called it. But anyways, that maybe there's some tunnel system underneath, and that they could surprise the enemy by going and actually knocking out some of the pillars that would cause the ground to collapse, and then they could escape out some secret hatches that would surprise them from behind. And so that wasn't in the book. It came straight out of this exploration process. So when the director has the time and the qualified previs team to go and explore these things, and without really remote controlling the individual artist, but saying, like, I need your ideas. Here, show me your ideas. And that's where a lot of the work came from, including a lot of the tree, all of the moving tree stuff that we did, and all of those individual moments, some of which Andrew Adamson really fell in love with and wanted to find ways to expand upon them. And to some extent, this is how I felt with Steven Spielberg, where he would take something that he had initially pitched to us, we would pitch it back to him, and he'd say, well, it's not exactly what I was thinking, but you know what I like about it? I love this, and I love him as the centerpiece, and I really love this shot, so let's take that moment and expand upon it. And I think it's that additive direction philosophy, instead of a destructive or more of an editorial approach where you take stuff out, if you keep adding onto the vision, that's the way to go. So that's sort of what happened with the battle sequence.
Now, if we move to the river god for a second, the river god in the book, it was the trees that their roots came and kind of crushed the bridge, which reads well but doesn't sort of cinematically play out nearly as dramatically as what ended up in the film. But in the case of the river god, you had some really solid concept art, some really magnificent, breathtaking kind of imagery to inspire.
Well, this is the challenge, because you have awesome concept artwork that it comes from some super talented guys that came up with the vision before the final visual effects were rendered. I mean, this is something that's very close to the way it ended up looking like. And so we wanted to stay very faithful to that. And at the same time, we also had somewhat of a vague idea of what this real location would be like. So it's really the job of the previous team to be Sherlock Holmes and to figure out how to problem solve so that you can come up with a fairly reasonable representation of what the dimensions of the set are going to be from maybe just a couple of photos taken by some PAs out there. Usually we don't get any very professional survey data. We just have to cobble it together from pictures that look like my dad took the pictures or something. And that and a couple of rough maps where they're like, I think it's here somewhere, and a bunch of topology information. That's how we build our set. And we're usually given like less than a week to come up with a set and all the characters that we need to throw into this. So that we can get very quickly into conceptualizing what it is in 3D space. So we're always taking a look on one side, the concept artwork, and on the other side, the reality of what the production will face when they get out there on the day, and putting it together for the very first time in motion. So that's what we do, and that's what we did on Narnia for the River God sequence, which is the sequence I'm referring to, and it's kind of a good example, because we took that from concept to previs, and then from previs to post-vis. And post-vis is this term that everyone seems to be using these days, because I guess it just makes sense. It's post-vis is anything that happens after the principal photography has been captured, so that basically the previs team is tapped again to take all those animations that they did in previs and integrate them back into the plates, and possibly do some plate manipulation. All of the stuff that the final visual effects companies are going to have to do, but just a lot quicker. And since all the stuff is already available but to the previous team, it makes a lot of sense to do this, I think. And so this came about with the big battle sequence and also with the River God finale, to have to do post-vis for this for a screening.
I mean, there was actually some concern about cutting that sequence, because, you know, looking at the cut with just a bunch of guys going, uh-oh, looking up at blue screens really wouldn't have played that strongly.
Well, this is often the case. This definitely happened also on another movie called Meet Dave, which is Eddie Murphy's next movie. And literally the directors will come to us and say, hey, so, because usually by then they've built up a real close personal relationship with us, and they say, hey, I need your help. We're about to show this to the studio, and I know it's going to be good, but right now there's no visual effects in here. Like in the case of the River God, they were looking at a whole bunch of big empty skies and a bunch of goofy-looking people that are jumping off of this bridge that they built, but it looks badly composed because the visual effect is not there, and the story is not really discernible at that point. It happened on Meet Dave with a big finale sequence that just seemed too technically hard to pull off, and the studio was like, I'm not sure if we want to spend this money. You're just going to have to find a clever Alfred Hitchcockian way to show this or to circumvent this sequence, and they really didn't want to do that. So through the previs, sometimes that sequence can be saved, and certainly in the post-vis, they can assure themselves, both at the studio level and to the directors and the production itself, that this is a sequence which is going to work. And I'm always a firm believer in if you can look at the previs or the posters or both and take a look at that and go, wow, I'm getting an emotional response already from this. I'm feeling the adventure. I'm sad for this character. Because of all the bells and whistles that we add on top of just the purely technical previs, then at that level you can make sure that this is something that's going to be great. It's great already. I can't wait until the final acting is in there, until the final visual effects is in there, because that's just going to be the icing on the cake that's going to make it even better.
Must help the visual effects house that then takes over the shots. I think in this particular case, it was Scanline that took over the River God.
Yeah, because for the River God sequence.
They'd be much more focused on what's actually going to be playing and shot.
Yeah, basically, and like what we did on Star Wars, it's our philosophy to make the 3D scenes that we create available to the final visual effects vendor. And they often use that as a starting point. And in many cases, we're doing a little bit of roto that they can use and definitely some tracking, some setup. But even if it's just a previs that's being handed over, we have to make sure that while we're doing all of this wildly conceptual previs, that we're being disciplined behind the scenes, even though it's not a real requirement at that time to be to pay attention to scale and all of these technical things. We have to do it, because that's the biggest complaint I heard from visual effects supervisors when we first started our company, was like, yeah, previs is great and all, but on the last 10 movies we worked on, we had to completely redo everything. Oh, by the way, it sort of led the director astray to thinking that kind of shot was possible. And so that's one of my biggest pet peeves, and I never want that to happen. And the way that we prevent that from happening is that we make sure that we're dealing with the most realistic set that we can create, and that we're staying true to film language and to the real mechanics of actual cinematic camera devices like dollies and jib arms and all of those things.
Now, you've discussed previs, you've discussed post-vis, but there's another thing, and I don't know what we're going to call it, which is I come to you and I want you to do something to basically act as a pitch reel for the, you know, what this film's going to look like before it's even greenlit.
This is something that really started happening. I know it was happening before this, but it happened even more during the writer's strike, actually, because all of a sudden studios had properties or people that they had hired to work with as directors, and they started coming to us and saying, hey, can you work with this filmmaker, and if we give you 5 weeks or a couple of months to work with this director, can you come up with a sequence, which is a sample that we can use to test this director out and make sure that he can do action sequences, or that the vision of his sequence will be compelling enough to make us want to greenlight this movie? And then there's a couple of other examples of independent people who have come to us and said, hey, we've been working on this idea. I have a little bit of money to explore this at the previs level to come up with a pitch trailer. And we've done a couple that are sort of investor-targeted pitch trailers that show the scope of the entire movie. And one of those has been very successful, actually, and helped to raise the money for the entire feature film.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking like $20 million movie. This is Lord of the Rings scope budget, 2 hours and 40 minutes currently. And I think it's hopefully part of what the future may bring if people can leverage previs technology like this. And it's really not about the technology. It's about the team and how you pull all that together ultimately. But if you're able to do it, create something that is watchable by anyone, no matter how uncreative they are, if you can go into a studio or a bunch of independent investors and press play and say, here is a portion of my movie or a potpourri sampling teaser trailer of my whole movie, then, and they get inspired and excited about it, then there's very little risk compared to the guys that come into the room just with the script.
So Chris,
and just with a couple pieces of concept artwork.
With the notion that we'll get an insight into how you actually work a shot, If you could indulge me, let's do exactly that. Let's imagine I come to you with FX Guide Productions, and we've got a shot of two guys running away from carpet bombing in a jungle.
Yes.
And just for the purposes of this discussion, of course, and let's discuss, you know me enough to want to work on this.
Sure.
What is your process to go from that to something that you would have at the point of sensibly discussing and showing a director and doing stuff? I mean, what's the actual steps for you?
Well, you know, this is what I tell my guys constantly here at the studio, and this is our process that we go through every time we embark on a new project. And it really just begins with gathering all that reference material, whatever the production has to offer, the script, the storyboards, the artwork, toys, other movies and references. And what we end up doing is we just get together and we discuss all those references and get excited about all the possibilities. And, ultimately, I end up researching the filmmaker themselves behind their back.
Oh, really?
To make sure. Well, yeah. I mean, what I do is I want to make sure that the work that we produce is preemptively tailored to the sensibilities of the director, because I think, you know, pre-production in general is all about being symbiotic with the director. So if you can go and study, for example, their earliest films, like their student endeavors, when they were freed up to do whatever it is that that inspired them at that early stage, I usually just take notes about what kind of conventions they used and cinematic language, and pitch that back to my team. And then we have that in mind as we're coming up with shots that are relevant to their movie. We might put in some blurry foreground objects and slow dollies into faces and things like that that, you know, subtly remind them of their past. And I think it really helps.
So if I like lots of slow motion shots of on wide angle lenses low to the ground, then you're going to sort of, you know, help me see that in this context, because that's what you sort of perceive that I already like.
Absolutely. I mean, right. It's all ultimately, you know, film. To be a filmmaker is all about style. You know, it's about putting your particular view of the world, your stamp on the film. Because, you know, another director would have a different idea about it. And I think if we're working for empowering the director, we don't want to circumvent the director. We don't want to just make every movie our aesthetic. You know, we do add a lot to the vision, which is our ideas and things like that. But I think first and foremost, we need to be of the same mind and, you know, try to play to the directors themselves. So basically, just going back to my process, as we take all this information, including what we know about the filmmaker, and then we begin to create all the toys, the assets that we need to have to literally start working in 3D space. So that's environments, characters, props, anything. I mean, if you're working on your own previs, you can use placeholder objects, but if we're presenting to a studio, usually we like to make those characters look very much like their live-action counterparts if they knew who the cast is. So we have a pretty fast way of coming up with fairly realistic-looking stars. And then what we end up doing is we just block it out in rough first. So I think a lot of the mistakes of some previous teams and the way that this process has gone before is they go straight into fully animated previs, which takes a little bit of time to flesh out per scene. But what I encourage our team to do is to literally just block it out like I used to do from my days in feature animation. And going from one static composition to the next, you can work out a lot of the editing details of how any particular composition will work with the composition around it. And, I'm a big stickler
for that blocking, you'd really want to know the lenses and sort of, you know, the kind of...
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You can work out all kinds of things, like, you know, how close is the subject, what kinds of lenses, and how is it cutting? Because ultimately, when you watch a movie, the cut between shot one and shot two is what you notice the most. Or maybe you don't notice it because the filmmaker has been so clever about how they hide that cut, or it works for whatever reason. But even before you really get into the motion of anything, you can work out all of those problems. And if you were to discover something that you want to change in a shot in the middle of a sequence, sometimes that can have lasting impact on the other shots in and around that shot.
So it must be really important to have accurate scale at this point, because once you start in, I imagine it's impossible to get out. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have to have a solid foundation to start on, and I think in the past there's been previses out there that are done with After Effects compositing all kinds of elements coming together, and this is, you know, beneficial to look at some imagery and to get some people excited about it. But ultimately, if you go back into those scene files and go, well, how high did the camera move relative to that character, and the character is 20 feet tall, then you're either going to get it wrong or you're going to have to do some pretty intense calculations to make sure that it's usable information on set. So it definitely pay attention to scale. And then what I do is ultimately, once that blocking is all worked out, we go into timing out the shots. And I really feel like, coming from my background at Disney Feature Animation, I learned a lot about both things. One, composition, and then also posing and animation. And animation to me is about posing and timing. And so I think that is the argument for why you need to have fairly realistic timing in previs, because if we'll talk about just the still composition, if the character is just posed up, but not posed up accurately to the way that the posture of the character might be, the composition will be completely off. It needs to be representative of what you're filming first before you can film
right.
it.
Right, so a bunch of sort of vertically standing up straight, turntable type models
working around. If
you're
just moving pawns around like that, then it's like it's misleading, because that's not going to be what the character is going to look like, and you may want to compose them completely differently. There's a lot of subtleties that play into composition just at that simplest level. However, when you're starting to get into motion, it gets even more complicated, of course, and that was one of the things that I learned, and that's how I became useful at Disney, was that I was able to animate to some extent, not as well as the amazing animators that were surrounding me that I was feeding, but I could learn their language and get it timed out good enough that when the camera that I used to film my little roughed-in animation was done, then that was in the ballpark of what they would need when they were hand-drawing the traditional animated characters to that 3D camera move. And so I've applied that same philosophy to what it is we do back at the studio
now,
here.
In our example, we've got guys running through the desert, through the jungle, so consequently we've got the camera having to move over or through awkward foliage and stuff. At this stage, are you worried about how it's going to be filmed in terms of, well, how am I going to get a camera there to film that? Or are you just trying to get the shot and then go back and say, okay, well, all that's going to have to be...
Well, we always have this underlying knowledge of what the visual effects community is going to have to do, or just even the live action guys on set. So we try to stay within those boundaries, but we're not too overly concerned with exact limitations on things other than just basic camera speed and some basic guidelines that we know that we can't go past. But for the most part, we're just pulling the camera in and we're trying to get the best possible shot. And then what we do is we'll attach that to a camera rig, a real representation of a camera rig, and make sure that we'll test the velocity, we'll test the length of the boom arms and things like that to make sure that we're within parameters. But I think that's the important thing, is to be able to work very quickly, to iterate through the process, to free, even though there's a lot of quality in what you do, you have to free up your artists to be able to move anything at any time and to change on the fly. And that's the power of previs.
This blocking at this stage, so we haven't got the characters actually animating, but we've got them moving posed, mm-hmm. and we're getting some timings down. Is it a grayscale image we're looking at, or have you added color yet? When does color or light become a factor?
Well, usually we have to build everything first, and then we start playing with it, because it's a little bit harder to start upgrading stuff as you go along. So if we make characters, they're already fully fleshed out to the point that we're happy with them, and then we'll plot them in the scene. And usually that's the way it works, is first week, everyone is rallying around building those assets. And since everyone here is a veteran generalist, but they have specialty skills, in addition to that, just like our original team at the ranch, there's always a couple of guys that are better model makers that can texture up a storm. And so they do that while maybe during that one prep week, we've got some guys that are more animation shot creator guys that are coming up with animation cycles or creating little canned effects that we use. So we basically have pre-built our arsenal, knowing roughly what it is that we're endeavoring to do. And this is all coming from our internal discussions and our discussions with the filmmakers, so that we're all basically sitting around in a room getting excited about the possibilities. Then we build everything, then we start to implement, and we do so with a sense of responsibility for having to feed all this to the final visual effects vendors.
Which means you don't really use proprietary code, do you? Because it'd be hard to feed if you were using proprietary stuff. You tend to use off-the-shelf almost software to do this.
Well, yeah, I think it's a big mistake to use proprietary software at our level, because we don't have a gigantic R&D department, or nor do we need to make cutting-edge imagery. I always keep telling the software vendors that we work with, like, I'm happy with the software that you give us. Just make it faster and more stable. I mean, I'm a kid in a candy store already. It's a big open void. I can put anything I want in there and represent it with a bunch of textures on a plane, and I'm good to go. And it's all about just filming that. You know, then that becomes the hard part of the project is just the ideas that go into it, not the technology itself. But the other side benefit of keeping it non-proprietary is the fact that we get to take our scenes and literally just put them on DVD or a drive and hand them off to whoever wants to feed off of them. And they can literally, like they did on Star Wars, open them up and start to replace all of our pieces' parts if they want. And that's exactly what happened on Star Wars, though, I hear, is they had a bit of an integration department, and they would throw out anything they didn't want, but there was definitely some 3D positional data in there of our ships moving around relative to camera. They would usually, I think, take our cameras and then parent their high-res ships to our low-res ships, hide our low-res ship, and then end up adding a lot of additional subtlety and animation, and of course all of the love that goes into making it look real. That is 90% of the rest of the effort. But, you know, in general, I think there's been a lot of success with being able to hand off 3D scenes to 3D vendors. And ultimately, we want to be the best friends of all of the participants that come after us. And for them to actually say in the future, like, hey, yeah, I mean, we worked pretty well with these guys. And if you want to go away and as a filmmaker work on your project with these guys, we're pretty darn sure, as long as we have a few conversations as we go along, that naming conventions are going to work and the scale is going to work, and we're going to be able to get a lot of very useful information we can feed right into our pipeline. That will free us up to concentrate on the details and not struggle with recreating the wheel.
Well, look, we really appreciate you taking time to walk us through the process and talk about some of the projects you guys have done.
Absolutely.
It's terrific.
My pleasure.
And now you guys are now based where? You obviously were once at Skywalker.
We're in heart of Los Angeles on Wilshire Boulevard near La Brea, so at the end of the Miracle Mile there, in a nice little Art Deco office building. We've taken over the top floor of our building and expanded our team to 31 professional previs artists, working on a lot of really cool projects right now, and just very interested in meeting new filmmakers and anyone who wants to come by to see some of our later work. That would be great.
Well, thanks again for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much, Mike.
Well, thanks, guys. As I mentioned in the open, I really enjoyed Chris's presentation at VES last year, and I know Mike really enjoyed seeing the one that he recently did in Sydney as well. It's really a fascinating aspect of the business. If you want to see more about The Third Floor, be sure to check out our online article at effectsguide.com. It's got more information as well as links to various showreels that they have at the Third Floor's website, so be sure to check that out. I also want to take a moment to mention FX Sky TV. We've had a couple emails and questions about that. We haven't had one in a while, and it's not because we haven't wanted to have an episode out. It's just effectively a couple of our segments have gotten pulled due to clearance issues and other reasons. We've had them all in the can and ready to go, but haven't been able to air them. And we will be definitely having episodes coming out in the future, and we'll be trying to get back to our schedule of having them come out every 2 weeks or every 3 weeks and so forth moving forward. So be sure to check out the website for that. We'll have posts on the homepage, and if you subscribe to the FX Guide TV RSS page, you'll get updated when our episode comes out. Well, that's it for this week. If you want to drop us a line, feel free to do so via the links on our homepage, or drop us a line via email at podcast@fxguide.com if you have any comments or suggestions for future podcasts. For the FX Guide crew, Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. We'll see you next time.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.